It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, this week's edition of Food Friday is all about cooking on a tight budget. We'll talk to a mother of four who wrote a cookbook about making your money stretch in the kitchen. First, we're talking about momfluencers. You know, the beautiful blonde women who wear linen dresses and feed their adorable children perfectly homemade meals in their newly renovated beige homes. The ones who make motherhood spotless houses and getting toddlers to behave look not just fun, but easy. Our next guest describes herself as obsessed with momfluencers, even though she often comes away from scrolling through their Instagram feeds with mixed feelings. We're talking about what mothering looks like on social media and how it compares to the real deal. We want to hear what you think, moms. 1-800-642-1234. Do you follow any momfluencers online? And how do Instamoms make you feel about motherhood? And why do you follow them? Love to know. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Peterson is a writer and author of the new book Momfluenced: Inside the Maddening Picture Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did your obsession with momfluencers begin?
Yeah, it really started when I was a mother of a newborn and a toddler. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I found a blog. It was Love Taza was the name of the blog, and the momfluencer's name is Naomi Davis. And she lived in the Upper West Side of New York City. She had three kids. Her photos were beautiful. They were well lit. They were well composed. And her performance of motherhood was just really joyful. She made motherhood look like an adventure, sort of like she was starring in her own movie. And as a mother, you know, myself at the time, really struggling to find that sense of joy and ease in my own experience, I found this, you know, very performative aspect of motherhood online really interesting and sometimes maddening, but I wanted to sort of understand my own feelings about it better.
Yeah, they make it look so good and they make it look so easy, but then you start digging into what a day in the life of a momfluencer looks like. And what did you find, Sarah?
Yeah, it's a ton of work. I mean, you know, many of these women are photographers, they are editors, they're writers. They're business women. They are, you know, dealing with brands and sponsorship deals. It's not an easy job, and only the top percentage of monetized momfluencers make enough to live on. Brooke Erin Duffy wrote a book about style influencers and female influencers in general, and found that only about 9% make enough to support their families doing this. So yeah, it's a ton of work and it's skilled work for sure.
Yeah. And when many of us think of momfluencers or mommy bloggers, we tend to think of conventionally attractive married white ladies with beautiful homes selling expensive strollers. And that is a big part of it. But you write about how momfluencer culture is actually a lot more diverse than that. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. I mean, the momfluencer you were sort of speaking to, I think, is the predominant stereotype we think of when we think of momfluencer culture. But there are so many moms from all walks of life that you can find on Instagram and elsewhere, other social media platforms. Many of them are speaking about social justice issues. Many of them are providing really important representation. And this representation can be really powerful. I spoke to one disabled momfluencer who said that she only became a mother once she saw another mother in a wheelchair on Instagram and sort of, you know, felt like, oh, this is actually possible for me, because she just hadn't seen her identity represented in, you know, mainstream mom media.
Reading from your book here. And yes, Instagram sucks, of course, but it's but it's also an invaluable resource for advocacy and activism. One of the moms that sticks out in my mind from your book, Sarah, is Erica Nolan.
Trans mom. For sure. Yeah. She's a trans mom I spoke to for the book. And she has really used her platform to create more visibility about her experience coming out as trans. And again, she told me she doesn't know if she would have transitioned if she had not followed other trans women online first. So this is like a really, you know, meaningful way that representation goes beyond just, I feel good because I see my identity represented online. It's impacting people's real life choices.
And yet the veneer is obvious, I think, to anybody who looks at it. That can't be real. And to a degree, it's not. But what kind of effect does that sort of unreal and yet somehow empowering social media feed have on other mothers?
Yeah, I think it really depends. In the book, I talk a little bit about upward comparison theory and downward comparison theory. And so, upward comparison theory is when we are maybe, cringe following or quote unquote hate following someone whose values we don't agree with in order to sort of feel better about our own values and our own life choices. And downward comparison theory is when we are consuming content. These people might be succeeding, or we might perceive these people to be succeeding in ways that we are failing. And this does have the effect of making us, feel less good about our lives and less good about our choices. So I do think it's the type of thing where folks need to be really honest with themselves and sort of assess, like, how is this impacting my behavior? How is this impacting my well-being? Because once we consume these images, they really live inside us in ways that I don't think are necessarily easy to quantify.
Sarah Peterson, our guest, she is the author of the new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 about your relationships that you see on social media, the performance of motherhood that you find, and the reality that is our lives. Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And of course, a huge part of Momfluencer Culture, Sarah, is consumer. And I'd be curious from you, and it's parts in the book, some of the things you've bought as a result of the momfluencers you follow.
I think maybe, I don't know, the quirkiest thing I've purchased is a wooden marble run. I don't know if you're
No,
familiar with
I
marble
think I had
runs.
one as a kid.
Yeah. So yeah, one of, my pet momfluencers, her kid was playing with this beautiful, probably Swedish made wooden marble run. And I saw the image, I saw the kid playing, and I, it translated in my mind as like, I can get free time. I can get quiet. My kid will be as absorbed as her kid is with this marble run. And I think I spent like $73 on the marble run. And
Shush.
yeah, it wasn't a magical experience, I'll tell you that.
But we talked earlier this week with a researcher who talked about how when we scroll through social media, our defenses for impulse buying are lower just because our senses are overwhelmed with, we're taking it all in, all these many things all at once. And all of a sudden, something comes by that trips us up and stops us in our tracks. And we think, yeah, that might actually make a difference until it arrives at your doorstep and you realize it probably won't.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's so true. And the quick little dopamine hits you can also access so easily from clicking purchase now.
Yes.
And I think especially moms, we're so unsupported in this country, and it makes sense that we want to feel hope that our lives can be easier. And it's silly, of course, to think that something like a marble run will meaningfully impact my experience as a mother. But in those moments, you're scrolling, the link is right there, your credit card is saved in your phone or your computer. And it feels like one tiny step that you can make towards having a better experience of motherhood.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Lisa in Madison joins us. Lisa, you're on the air with Sarah Peterson, the author of Momfluenced.
Hi, as a 53-year-old mother of now adult children, I don't pay attention to the mom influencers, but I think part of that is because of the awareness I had as I was growing up and looking through fashion magazines and the pressure to look a certain height and a certain weight, and the reality behind how those women looked, it was just as unglamorous as some of the lies of these mom influencers, eating disorders and a lot of mental health problems and the pressure. So it's just kind of, this is a continuation of what women have seen as, teenagers and now adults and mothers. the pressure.
Oh, you cut out, but your point was very well taken, Lisa, and thank you so much for the call. And I guess as I'm listening to Lisa here, I'm thinking there is a limited number of pages in these fashion magazines to present a limited view of what a woman is. But when you get online, you get to a certain degree, you get to call your own feed. You get to figure out where your follows will be. And there is, as you write in Momfluence, there is a large diversity of women to follow on social media.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the caller's right to point out that we've always been marketed and sold a certain way to be as women and as mothers. Just the medium has changed. And I guess what I find, compelling, troubling, interesting about this medium is, you know, how we can form parasocial relationships with these women. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about the fashion magazines from 20 years ago, sure, we could consume the narrative, you know, that we should all be a certain weight and we should all, you know, have a certain skin color and conform to certain beauty ideals. But we didn't know what their kid ate for breakfast. We didn't know where that model lived. We didn't know her husband's name. And I think knowing so much personal information about these people can make them that much more effective as consumer sites.
Fascinating. We're talking with Sarah Peterson about her new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Moms, we want to hear from you. What do you think of the way motherhood's represented on social media? What do you want to see more of on your social media feed? And what do you want to see less of, for that matter? Do you follow any Insta-moms? And have the moms of Instagram affected the way you feel about yourself and your family? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation with writer Sarah Peterson about her new book, Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. And your thoughts of momfluencers and the Instamoms you find online, the veneer they present and the reality that we're living. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And Sarah, you talk to a lot of women who make money from posting about motherhood, either full-time or part-time. How do they feel about their jobs?
Almost all of the people I spoke to for the book had complicated feelings about this. I spoke to one woman who had been talking to a social media manager, and the manager was like, listen, if something bad happens in your day, if you cry, you need to film yourself because that will get engagement, that will bring viewers in, that will create a compelling narrative. And just the idea of having to mine your personal, you know, trauma for clicks is so fraught to me, especially when it comes to motherhood, which is such a vulnerable experience for many of us. And you know, many of them talked about having tough experiences, revealing too much, or allowing themselves to be too open to their followers' feedback. I think it's a really tricky line to walk because they're also expected to be quote unquote authentic. And that's a word that has ceased to mean much of anything at all, as far as I'm concerned. It's really just like what the consumer wants to see from you to feel like, you know, if you're selling them something, an affiliate link or a sponsored content, you're doing it for good reasons. And I don't know, there's a lot of criticism lobbied towards momfluencers for making money from this, which I think is pretty ridiculous because it is marketing, it is advertising, and they should be paid for their labor just the same way that marketers and advertising in traditional formats are paid for their labor.
Yeah, as you write about in the book, these moms of Instagram are expected to stay within particular economic configurations, and if they don't, all of a sudden they become inauthentic online. But you do raise a good question of what authenticity means when we're all willing to accept to some degree that what we're seeing is a presentation and far from the reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing about the momfluencers as a job is it eradicates the modern need to balance work and maternity, and it collapses the two. And considering, and you talk a lot about this in your book, what moms went through during COVID and how they are still recovering today, that was pretty important for a lot of mothers.
Yeah, I mean, most workplaces do not make room for a mother as a full person. She's expected to leave her mothering identity at the door. Otherwise, it's deemed, you know, unprofessional. And this is also why I think MLMs continue to thrive, because moms are not given ample resources to thrive in both professional settings and at home. Childcare is, you know, either exorbitantly expensive or impossible to find. And it makes sense to me that people are looking for, you know, loopholes, whether that's working for an MLM or whether that's momfluencing and trying to gain some sort of balance.
Sarah Peterson, our guest, the author of Momfluenced: Inside the Maddening Picture Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. And we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And here's an email from Leah. Sarah, I'm curious to see what happens to these kids who have been online since birth. When they get old enough to know what their parents are posting and doing, they have rights to what their image is online, says Leah. And what emotional repercussions this may have for them.
It's such an important question. I've been thinking a lot about child actors recently and, you know, really trying to suss out, like, how much knowledge and awareness do they have going into the industry? Certainly many of the moms I spoke to for the book are really open with their kids about, like, you know, this is a business, I am earning money. Many of them put, you know, have trust funds for their kids and are putting aside a certain percentage of the money they make. But the issue of consent is really, really hard. And I think for many of these momfluencers who are millennials, and, you know, they had their kids when Instagram was a new technology. And I don't think we were thinking necessarily about privacy and consent in the same way we are now. So I think it's a real concern. And other countries also have, like, legislation in place and policies in place to protect children and to make sure children are paid fairly. And I think that might be at least one way to safeguard children.
You end your book, Momfluence, Sarah, talking about the ideal of cruel optimism. Can you share a little bit about what that means and your thoughts on how it relates to motherhood?
Yeah, it's a theory by literary theorist Lauren Berlant, and it essentially posits this idea of longing for something, usually an ideal or an archetype, even when that thing that we're longing for prevents our flourishing or, you know, directly counteracts our ability to flourish. And I talk about my own story in the book, wanting to sort of inhabit this domestic ideal of motherhood, you know, be a goddess of the home. And in researching where that archetype stems from, you know, the 19th century cult of domesticity, where wealthy white women were upheld as the moral centers of the home, it's not coming from a great place. Only certain moms could be, quote unquote, true women. And even those moms were oppressed. And any other type of mom that did not fit into that category of wealthy white womanhood was explicitly prevented from, you know, joining the club of, quote unquote, true women. And many of them were explicitly harmed because they could not adhere to that ideal. So, yeah, I think momfluencer culture is a great example of cruel optimism. You know, it's normal and natural to want something better as mothers, but I think we have been continuously programmed to want an ideal that really is not good for us.
How did the momfluencers that you talked to for this book, Sarah, feel about the negative perception that many people have about their work?
Frustrated. I think namely because they are women and mothers, their work is denigrated as frivolous or as inconsequential. And the motherhood piece really shows up when people will say things like, oh, they should be spending time with their kids instead of looking at their phones, or, oh, they just want me to buy something from them. They don't really care. And it's like, okay, so the mom who's working an office job 9 to 5 is also not spending time with her kid, but that's somehow different. There's this really misogynistic criticism of mothers having the audacity to make money, which I think is really wrapped up in this discussion.
Mm. Yeah, before the pandemic, we had for the very first time more women in the workforce than men. And during the pandemic, we dropped down to a level that had not been seen since the 1980s. And we had the job numbers out earlier today where those numbers are bouncing back again towards closer to pre-pandemic levels. But it goes back to the trying to have it all as a woman in America and how many forces are up against you and how for these momfluencers, in many ways, they're taking the opportunity in their own hands. But a little, I'm still curious a little bit more about the marginalized women in our society and where they find empowerment online and what you found about them, Sarah.
One important thing to remember about social media is that for all of its, you know, pitfalls and weaknesses, it is a democratic space. You know, anyone can create an Instagram account. And many marginalized moms have found real audiences and engagement online where they might not otherwise have. You know, if you think about writing and disseminating messages prior to social media, you had to jump through lots of gates. You had to have connections to academia or to the publishing industry or to TV and film. And without, you know, now with social media, many, many more people can create communities and can share their voices in meaningful ways. And certainly marginalized mothers have created vibrant, thriving, meaningful communities through social media. I think of Mia O'Malley. She's a fat momfluencer, and she crowdsourced a network of weight-inclusive healthcare providers.
Sarah, I apologize. We're out of time. Have to leave it there. But I really appreciate you joining me today. Sarah Peterson, she's the author of Momfluenced, Inside the Maddening Picture-Perfect World of Mommy Influencer Culture. We've got Food Friday coming up next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, a year in the life of a teacher. We'll meet the journalist who followed the struggles and successes of educators in the classroom and in their personal lives. Now, making delicious and healthy meals in the kitchen doesn't have to be expensive or take hours to prepare. Some of us can't afford the fancy fare, the rare ingredients, but we still need to find ways to feed our families. Fortunately, low budget doesn't have to mean low flavor. It's Food Friday, and today we're talking all about saving money in the kitchen and the grocery store with the help of someone who's mastered it in her own life for her own family. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. How do you make your money stretch further in the kitchen? What's your favorite cheap and easy meal, go-to meal? And what questions do you have about keeping costs for cooking down? 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lexi Rogers is a chef and mother of four who competed on season 11 of the reality cooking show Master Chef. Her new cookbook is called Break Bread on a Budget. Ordinary ingredients, extraordinary meals. Lexi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I think we're on the same page here when it comes to breaking bread on a budget. So I'm very interested in talking to you because when I got your book, I'm like, all right, this is going to be about dried beans, right? Dried beans. We're just going to talk about dried beans here. And that was far from the case. You run the gamut in your cookbook and you do it on a budget. And I'm just fascinated with it. Let's start, though, with your experience on MasterChef. The judges were amazed when you said you could feed your family on $40 a week. It was just you and your husband back then. And you've added a few more mouths since then. But how did you do it? What was your secret?
So we just took really simple items and tried to make them as flavorful as possible, knowing what kind of, you know, ingredients pair well together really helped. We ate a lot of rice. We still eat a lot of rice, a lot of potatoes, pasta, things like that. are cheap and can take up a lot of the bulk of your meal and fill you up. And then you can swap them out and make them delicious by the things that you add to that. And those ingredients don't have to cost very much either.
Yeah. What was your experience like on MasterChef? How was that for you?
It was a little bit stressful. It was a lot of bit stressful. Gordon is, you know, he can be very intimidating. I had no culinary background going onto the show, and I later found out that a decent amount of my fellow contestants had a lot more experience, whether they've traveled the world and tasted different types of cuisines or actually like went to school or grew up in restaurants themselves. So I felt a lot of pressure, felt really out of place. I also was pregnant and didn't realize it until like the day after I got there. So that was a challenge in itself. But I had a lot of fun. I made a lot of great friends. I learned a lot about, you know, flavor and what things can pair well together. And I took that and I still apply that today in the kitchen.
You wrote in your book that you initially felt ashamed of being labeled as the poor Black girl, but you've grown instead to be proud of the ingenuity you have in the kitchen. And can you take us through some of what it was like for you and your feelings around identity and cooking?
Yeah. So when you get there, you know, MasterChef is supposed to be exquisite. It's the top of the top. You're supposed to be plating really beautifully. You're supposed to be taking ingredients and elevating them. And while that is something that I tried to do minimalistically, it wasn't something that I had a ton of experience with. And I was just, you know, notice that a lot of times they'll take, you know, like Black single mothers, which I'm married to, you know, my husband, Lewis, but Black single mothers and people who just don't have a lot of resources, and then just kind of like make that their, you know, their title and say, okay, well, this is what we expect from you. And I wanted to be so much more than that. I wanted to show that, you know, my race didn't matter, how little or how much I had to cook with didn't matter. And that there's other people, a whole community of people who are just like me, who are able to do these same things and kind of be an inspiration to those people as well. And so I took it very seriously. I knew that this was something that they were kind of trying to, you know, force on me and label me as. And while I didn't appreciate that during the show, I realized afterwards I can use that same thing and really try to impact, you know, my community.
Chef Lexi Rogers, our guest, her new cookbook is Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients and Extraordinary Meals. And while you talk about being an inspiration for others, your book also talks about your inspiration, Lexi, your auntie and your grandma. Tell us about them.
Yes. So my grandma and my aunt both live in inner city Chicago. It's where my father grew up, and I would visit them and sometimes stay with them for extended periods during the summer. And the thing that I loved the most about my grandmother was that she would cook, and before we would come over, she would ask, like, is there anything that you want to eat? And is there anything that I can get you? Random people stopped by and knew that she was making dinner and just took a plate, said hi, took a plate, and went about their way. And I just thought that was so beautiful. It wasn't something that I saw a lot until I started really spending time over there. And it really inspired me, the way that she was able to take food and really simple ingredients and make something that tasted delicious, but also really brought people together. And it was really something that, you know, touched me, something that I wanted to also be able to share with other people.
Yeah, feeding others as love of others. And I think that's something my grandmother imparted to me. So, Lexi, let's get down to it then. Let's talk about how you can build a meal for a whole family on a real tight budget. And a few rules that stuck out to me. Number one, don't shop hungry. That's a bad idea. The second one, though, I think is kind of tough for me. Don't cook tired. That's not a good idea. But sometimes that can be tough. What are some of the rules of the road that you abide by?
Yes. So when I talk about not cooking tired, one of the biggest things is not just physical tired, but it's mental exhaustion. And a lot of times you take the idea of, okay, what am I going to cook today? And what am I going to eat for lunch? And then what am I going to make for my kids for tomorrow? And what are we going to pack for them? And all these things, there's so many decisions to make, so many choices. And so I like to, before the week even begins, say, okay, this is what we're going to do. These are the meals we're going to have on Monday. All the things we're going to have on Tuesday. Wednesday is going to be a leftover day. And so it just kind of takes some of that tiredness out before my week even begins. I know what that week is going to look like. My family knows what it's going to look like, and just kind of gives us a little bit more peace. And so you have a little bit more energy throughout your week.
And then, Lexi, you take that menu and you turn it into a grocery list that becomes kind of like what you're going to stick to once you get there.
Correct. Exactly. Which, again, helps save money. You get to the store and you're like, oh, I don't really know what I'm going to make for this week. You just kind of end up grabbing random items, and then you have to figure out what to turn them into. Maybe you don't have a certain ingredient, and you run back to the store to get something to make that into a meal. And you keep doing that throughout the week. And before you know it, you've spent way more than you would like to. You've traveled to the grocery store a lot more than you'd like to, which cuts into, you know, your gas budget or whatever. And you're also a lot more tired. I personally do not like to cook after I grocery shop. So whatever day is my grocery shop day, that day we're either having frozen pizza or we're having leftovers or something really simple. I don't want to touch food after that. I'll get in the kitchen the next day. But if you're running to the store all the time, it becomes difficult to do that. And so I think it's really important to have a weekly menu. I think anything longer than a week, you start to get a little bit overwhelmed, or things start to, you know, go bad in your fridge and you forget them or whatever. But you know, a week seems to be a good amount of time for me and my family, to focus on and just kind of work with that.
Lexi Rogers, our guest. She is the author of the new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And you can join us with your suggestions and how you make the dollar go further in your grocery store or once you get to the kitchen, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. What are some of the staples that you have on hand in the Rogers household, Lexi?
So we always have frozen veggies, you know, frozen broccoli, frozen peas. Sometimes if I'm really lazy, like a frozen medley is in there. We always have rice. I buy extremely large bags of rice, 10-pound bags of rice. They don't go bad. And you can put them in a lot of different things. Another staple is chicken. It's easy to freeze, easy to thaw out. It'll stay good in your freezer for about a year, almost a year. And so if you have that on hand, then you always have either a protein or a starch. Same thing with potatoes. I like to keep a lot of potatoes around. Butter. Always keep butter. I say butter is flavor, and we like to have lots of that. So I can freeze my butter as well. And when I have a little bit more, then I'll put some of it towards grabbing an extra thing of butter, because it can be expensive if you're, you know, if you don't actually have that built into your budget. So I try to keep that on hand as well. And then my favorite seasoning, I'm not sponsored by these people at all, but Tony's Cajun seasoning is my favorite. I write about it in my book.
Yes, you do.
I use it in a lot of my recipes. I'm telling you, I will put that on anything and it makes it taste amazing. So
I put it
definitely
on my grocery
encourage you guys
list.
To invest
yeah.
in that.
I caught that in your book, and I appreciate that. There's another staple that you write in your book that surprised me, because it took me back to college, and I think I had so much of it in college, I haven't even thought of it as an adult. Ramen noodles.
Ramen.
Actually. Yeah.
Yes. We love ramen.
How do you use it?
I use it, you know, pretty much how they tell you to cook it. Sometimes we don't actually make it with, like, in a soup. Sometimes we'll toss it in like, soy sauce or some other kind of sauce and make it more of like a pasta kind of thing. You can add a bunch of different stuff to it, chicken, shrimp, salmon, sometimes crispy fried onions or soft boiled eggs, hard boiled eggs. I mean, so many different choices that you can add to that and just make it like a nice filling dish. And the actual packets itself are extremely cheap. The seasoning that comes with it doesn't taste bad as either. If you want to be a little more healthy, because I know there's a lot of MSG in there, you can make your own seasoning. We use chicken bouillon cubes instead of chicken broth. And so those things, I think a jar of it is like $2 in some sense, and you get like 20 plus different bouillon cubes in there, and you can grind them up however you please, chop it up with the fork. I have a mortar and pestle that I like to grind it up with, mix it with some water and some other different seasonings, and then add that to my noodles as well if I want to be a little bit healthier. But yeah, no, there's so many different choices, and we love to cook with ramen.
Yeah, it's so cheap. Break bread on a budget, ordinary ingredients, extraordinary meals, a new cookbook from our guest, Lexi Rogers, and you can join our conversation with how you make the dollar go further when you cook your meals for your family, your tips, and what's been passed down from generation to generation to you at 1-800-642-1234. Go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Chef Lexi Rogers. She competed in the reality cooking show Master Chef, and she's with us today to talk about her low-cost cooking and her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where Peggy in Cumberland standing by. Peggy, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great, thanks. What do you have for us today?
Oh, well, I was going to tell you about my mom's pour soup.
Oh.
She got the recipe from her, from my dad's mother, who raised kids in the Depression.
Yep.
And it's really basic, and it's pretty yummy, actually. You take half a pot of water, bring it up to a good boil, and drop little bits of hamburger in it. We usually use like a pound of hamburger. Let it boil for a while till the hamburger's all cooked out, and then I always stick it in the fridge overnight so I can skim the fat off and let the flavor set in a little. And then the next day, bring it up to boiling again, add an onion, a chopped onion, and a bunch of potatoes cut into pieces, and it's so good.
And so
gotta
affordable.
Start it with some homemade bread, though.
Oh.
Gotta dunk it.
Oh, nice.
Lexi, what's your thought on Ma's pour soup here?
Sounds so interesting. I've never tried that or heard of that before, but it's giving me some ideas of things that I could maybe use in my kitchen too.
My idea for you.
So thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking that Tony's Cajun seasoning would go great in that.
Right?
Exactly. And you've got a chapter in your book about soups and how to make those stretch, and the bouillon makes sense to me. What are some other tips you have for making soups stretch for the whole family?
Well, you mentioned it earlier, and I'm going to say beans.
Yeah. Thank you.
We like to use beans, and even if you don't want like the actual bean in there, you can blend it up and add it to your soup as a thickening agent, and then it gives it a little bit, you know, makes it a little heartier and makes it feel like the soup is stretching further.
Yeah, when I was on a tight budget, it was bean soup, it was bean salad. You could take vinegar and oil and take a bag of beans, soak them up, get them nice and soft, and then they could become just about anything. But they're always, for me, a really cheap protein. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that was such a small part of your book, Lexi, that I was amazed. Another part of your book is the way you use, and I mentioned vinegar before, pickling to preserve. And you've got a little bit of that in there. Tell us about how we can use pickling to save things, make them stretch, and keep them for as long as we need them.
Yeah, I mean, you can pickle almost any vegetable that you have in your fridge that's potentially going bad. It's super easy to do. I think you take one part of water, one part of vinegar, boil it together, add your veggies, and then I like to put a little bit of sugar in there as well just because the vinegar taste could be kind of strong. Seal it up in a jar, let it sit in your fridge overnight, and you've got a snack that you can use that could have potentially been thrown away.
Lexi, you talk a lot about eggs for breakfast in your book, The Incredible Edible Egg. But most recently, I've seen The Incredibly Expensive Egg. And I was
correct,
wondering how
yeah.
you and your family's budget dealt with the recent high cost of eggs.
Yes, eggs have become a lot more expensive than they were when I was first writing this book. We have been using a lot of oatmeal for breakfast. We use a lot of homemade pancakes, which are super easy and cheap. Flour is not that expensive. Yeah. And if I do use eggs, I would like to reference the mini frittata recipe that's in the book. And I like that one because you can use the recipe exactly how I've listed it, or you can add it in whatever kind of like leftovers you have from your week in there as well. So you take scrambled egg, sometimes like we'll have leftover turkey sausage, or if you want to put little pieces of cooked bacon in there, some leftover veggies that are going to go bad instead of pickling them, mm-hmm. you can add them to an egg batter, put it in the oven, and then you can snack on them throughout the week.
How about picky eaters? You've got three kids who are eating at home, four now, and picky eating can be difficult, but picky eating on a budget may seem downright impossible. How do you overcome those not necessarily distinguished palates, but picky ones?
Yeah, so we do eat a lot of chicken because my son, and salmon. My son, those are his two favorite proteins, and he is my pickiest eater. But I found that the thing that really helps us the most is having him in the kitchen with me and cooking with me, because then he feels like it's something that he made as opposed to looking at and saying, oh, I don't know what this is. This looks gross or it smells weird. You know, if he's a part of the process and he's in there with me and not really like cutting things, but, you know, like sauteing things, flipping things around, just knows what's going on, then he seems to be a lot more inclined to eat it afterwards.
You also talk about putting a thing of pizza dough down, a little pizza sauce and some cheese, and having the kids make their own pizzas real quick.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That is another really great, cheap meal to make. You can make your own pizza dough with yeast packets, which are incredibly cheap, and some flour that we probably all have on hand. Or what I've been doing lately, since I'm a little bit lazy, and we talked about that mental exhaustion, don't want to tire yourselves out in the kitchen. If you go to Walmart, you can find a little thing called Pizza Buddy, and it's going to be with the Walmart brand freezer pizzas. And we take it, you thaw it out, you can roll it out, and it's just a pizza dough that's ready to go. It tastes much better, and it's much cheaper than buying, you know, the ones that come in a can and already rolled up, or the ones that are dried out and in the actual, like, pizza sauce section. So we've been doing that a decent amount, too, and adding, you know, just some, you can get regular tomato sauce that's not necessarily pizza sauce. Walmart sells them for like 80 cents.
Yep.
And season it. I'm going to add Tony's in there again. Season it and, you know, make it taste your own and use that instead of actually buying jars of pizza sauce, which can be a little bit more expensive. Yep. And then top it with some cheese and you've got a really nice dinner that everybody in the family can make and super easy to enjoy and eat.
Lexi Rogers, our guest for Food Friday today, her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And here's where you got me, was with the can of biscuits and the everything you can do with a can of biscuits, from donuts to monkey bread to mozzarella monkey bread. Is there anything a can of biscuits can't do, Lexi?
No, not that I've seen.
So take us through how you would take a can of biscuits and turn it into some mozzarella monkey bread.
Yeah. So it's really easy to do. You can, you know, pop the biscuits open. I like to cut each biscuit piece. You know, they're pre-separated. Cut each piece into four, flatten it out a little bit, cut a piece of mozzarella stick off, put it inside of the biscuit, seal it tight. And then I put it in a bun dish and layer them in there, add a little bit of melted butter, as well as some Italian seasoning. Put in the oven, take it out, and then you've got pull apart mozzarella monkey bread. It's delicious.
I'm looking forward to trying that because I've done the donuts and I've done the sweet monkey bread, but the mozzarella monkey bread is now on my list, on my grocery list, on my menu. What's on the Rogers family menu for this weekend, Lexi?
Yeah, so today we are going to have some chicken Indian curry. I have some red curry paste that's in the fridge. We, you know, it's really easy to make. Just grind up some. We like to grind up some ginger as well as a little bit of a splash of lime. There's some red peppers, roasted peppers in there, and some other Indian spices. And I add that to a little bit of coconut milk and cook my chicken in there. And then we serve it with rice on the side. And it's really delicious. My kids love it. I love it. And the leftovers taste even better the next day.
Lexi, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. It was a joy.
Lexi Rogers is a chef and mother of four who competed on season 11 of the reality cooking show Master Chef. With us today to share her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And we encourage you and invite you to see our full slate of Food Friday guests online anytime at your leisure, along with all the recipes to boot at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, coming up Monday on the morning show, it's your state capitol report every Monday on the morning show. And Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction joins Kate Archer Kent to talk about the education spending that's been cut from the governor's proposed state budget. Kate will also be talking with the head of the Department of Children and Families about the child care crisis in Wisconsin. Plus, don't miss the founder of the Wisconsin Cryptids, Anomalies, and Paranormal Society as they share all that's unexplained across our state. That's Monday morning on the morning show. On October 1st, 1999, Andy Moore went on the radio to sing what he called the world's shortest bluegrass song. He was one of 72 guests who were interviewed in just 1 hour by Jonathan Zaroff on WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. 72 guests in an hour surpassed the station's previous record of 59. Well, earlier this morning, Andy Moore was hosting on WORT, and Jonathan Zaroff was the 72nd guest. And Moore would go on to set a new station record of 86 interviews in an hour. That works out to about 40 seconds per guest. And Governor Tony Evers was one of them in what could only be considered the world's shortest political interview. Congratulations to community radio station WORT and to the amazing Andy Moore for their new record. But we're public radio here, and it got us wondering about the record for the longest political interview and which elected official might help us break that record. Governor, this is Central Time.